Good morning, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of the Mad Tech Podcast, which we are bringing to you all the way from sunny Singapore with a delightful view in the offices of PhD Singapore. And I'd like to welcome our very special guest for the podcast this morning, Chris Stevenson, Head of Strategy and Planning APAC with PhD. I got that right, right?
You did. Welcome to the equator.
Yes, we're feeling Lindsay?
That's what it feels like.
Yeah. And of course, ably joined by ExchangeWise Head of Content, Lindsay Roundtree, otherwise known as part-time sound guy.
This is what I am. I'm a on the road sound guy.
Yes. I'm doing a spectacular job.
Well, thank you. Yep. Thank you very much, Chris.
Yeah, I second that.
Thank you. Well, you'll change your tune when you hear it, but that's fine.
Absolutely. For now, fine. It's looking like an impressive effort.
Good. Thank you.
Great. Okay, so let's launch into the news stories of this week. First news story that I wanted to chat with you guys, of course, it is we're in Singapore. Everybody else in the media industry is in the south of France. It's the week of Cannes Lions. And one of the stories to come out at the start of this week was about the announcement of a launch of a new industry collaboration called the Global Alliance for Responsible Media. So participating in this is a number of global brands, including big CPGs such as P&G, Unilever, and well-known global brands, Adidas, Mondelez, to name a few, being joined by representatives from agency holding groups as well, Group M, Dentsu, IPG, Publicis, and Omnicom, and joining ranks with the agencies and brands is also Google and Facebook and a whole other range of industry bodies like the WFA, the IAB, ISBA, ANA, Coalition for Better Ads, Mobile Marketing Association. So a whole load of people involved in this coalition. The point of the alliance is to be holding the industry to account to tackle harmful and misleading content. So this feels, and obviously as that relates specifically to the business of advertising and marketing. And this feels like it's pretty timely and relevant, since it's something obviously that we're sort of pretty obsessively talking about in the advertising and marketing industry, certainly over the last 12 months and more acutely over the last 6 months. So and one of the things that that one of the articles we read about this covered is that it follows on from the launch of the Conscious Advertising Network in the UK, which is looking to do a similar thing, specifically trying to reduce hate speech through tackling ad fraud as well and fake news. So very interested to hear what the two of you think about this. Like I said, it feels like now's a really interesting time for this to be sort of pulled together. And I'm specifically wanting to know how effective you think a coalition like this might be, and and whether they'll actually have any success in tackling some of the sort of like long-standing industry issues of ad fraud and the sort of associated challenges that go along with that. So Chris, start with you. What's your opinion on this new coalition?
Yeah, I think we're definitely having a moment over at Cannes around this topic. It's been a while coming, been a bubbling away for a while, and this is probably the most comprehensive and probably the most integrated attempt at getting something over the line on this. I think that as a group, as a body, it's going to be as effective really as they want to be. And I think it's also going to be as effective as the specific measures of success that they set themselves.
Yeah. And that's, I guess, the thing that I was really interested in is to what extent, how much power will a coalition like this have? It's a lot of really powerful organisations involved in it and like a really sort of sweeping long list of industry bodies as well. That indicates clearly that there's a lot of will to support something like this. But I often wonder, when you get that many people in the room, is it going to be a case of too many chefs and not enough sous chefs? Like, are we going to see some real action here, or do you think it will be?
It'd be good if there were some sous chefs in that group. That might be very productive.
Yeah, it could be, right?
But
what
I guess,
do you think,
I guess,
Lindsay?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's the point. Like, who's missing from this? I mean, as you said, these are very powerful organisations, and collectively as a collaboration, that should mean that they bring a wealth of power to this kind of massive raging issue within the industry. However, what it can also mean is that you get too many egos in a room and nothing actually really gets achieved.
Exactly.
And that's why you have, things like the IAB that are in the ad tech industry that are able to bring those companies together and act for them as an independent body. There's no real independent body of this coalition, so there's no kind of one singular voice that's speaking on behalf of all of them. If they all have to come together and make collective decisions, arguably, despite the fact there are some big names in this group, that might not happen, because they might all be working towards different standards themselves. And that, I think, is a challenge to think about as well. If you look at, you know, all the different standards, there's been lots of coalitions, lots of different kind of collaborations in the past, and some of them are really successful and some of them aren't. In fact, some of them, like Coalition for Better Ads, are part of this now. So you've got actually a coalition being part of a bigger coalition. It just all sounds really complicated. The premise of it is fantastic and it needs to be addressed. But also, you're also missing a fundamental part of the industry that is a fundamental part of, you know, where the ads go, which is on the publishers. They're not involved in this, and they do need to be.
Absolutely. I thought that was interesting, actually. So it talked about, you know, sort of media companies along the lines of Google and Facebook being involved. But what about some of the key, you know, big international publishers? We'd want to see their involvement as well to make it real, right?
Yeah. And the elephants in the room that aren't there, who are, of course, the regulators, that with the best will in the world, you've got a bunch of very powerful people coming to the table, even if they can get over the hurdle of those for the best will in the world vested interests, and they're all optimizing at different things. Even if we can get over that, the people who aren't at the table are the regulators, the people who are going to be driving policy in this area. And policy is playing catch up, but it's catching up.
Yeah. And that's another interesting thing, actually. I was thinking about this when we were chatting with Dennis Buckheim from IAB Tech Labs a couple of weeks ago. He was talking about how at IAB Tech Labs, they're specifically looking at developing, obviously, bits and pieces of technology tools to tackle industry issues like ad fraud and so forth. But we were talking about how some of the big, you know, sort of tech companies kind of run with their own initiatives, and how frustrating that can be from a Tech Labs point of view, because they're trying to do something that's sort of industry-wide. And so then it begs the question, how useful will a coalition be if people have also still got their own sort of initiatives and their own, understandably, their own priorities front and centre? That's what's sort of, you know, springs to my mind. And the other thing is, I was just wondering about this as well from your point of view, Chris. You know, what will, from your experience of working with a lot of brands, what will the brand perspective be on this? Because brands have obviously all got their own individual targets and milestones that they need to hit. You know, to what extent will they feel the ability to get collectively involved in something like this? Do you think it'll be a challenge for them?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of marketers are fundamentally insane in this regard, in the sense that they want two opposing things at the same time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But if you're a marketer or an advertiser, you want amazing quality inventory that is safe and viewed and good, and everyone is happy. At the same time, you've got margins, you've got price guarantees to drive down, you've got a whole range of KPIs across media and marketing that have got to be met. So within marketers alone, you've got a conflict over wanting to have the world as they want to see it, but also not always having the benchmarks from a pricing point of view to do it. And that's where the rubber's going to come. And that's just within marketers. You've got those same conflicts of interest within the other groups as well.
Yeah.
And so there are a lot of agendas within even individual groups at the table here.
Yeah, absolutely. What about the perspective of tech platforms, Lindsay? What's your sort of point of view on the degree to which, you know, other industry tech vendors might or might not get involved in this? Do you think they'll leave it to some of the industry bodies to kind of take a seat in this alliance? Or do you think some of them will get a little bit more actively involved? I mean, you mentioned obviously Coalition for Better Ads, which is already a sort of coalition, will be involved. And we know a lot of tech vendors have been heavily involved in trying to drive that forward. What do you think their role will be?
Just those who don't know, the Coalition for Better Ads, if people who don't know, is that just for nicer, better ads, or is that for a viewability standard?
It is
good question.
It's not for a viewability standard. It's actually for it is format based. So it's not about something looking lovely. It's about making sure that something is as pleasing and engaging to the user as possible. So for example, companies that adhere to the Coalition for Better Ads, it would mean you can't have anything that's a pop up or a pop over or a pop under. You can't have anything that kind of flashes and your auto plays. So anything autoplay, auto sound, all those kinds of things are not allowed under the Coalition for Better Ads. But obviously, it's not something enforceable. It's something that companies like Google, for example, have to say, I'm going to make sure that all of the ads that we deliver are going to be adhering to the Coalition for Better Ads guidelines. So it's a guideline, but it's not nothing to do with viewability. It's to do with user experience only, really. And that's an interesting point, though, really, from the kind of those tech platforms outside Google and Facebook that have joined this separately. They are all represented across multiple different trade bodies and multiple different coalitions under this. So they're going to be represented through Coalition for Better Ads, represented through IAB. Some of them are part of other initiatives that are part of this new thing as well. Like, I've forgot the name of, can't remember the name of it. It's quite long.
Oh, this thing. Or, yes. Yeah. Yes. Have to consult.
We can all call it a thing now because I actually can't remember the name of it.
Global Alliance for Responsible Media.
Oh, Global Alliance for Responsible Media.
GARM.
Yes.
GARM.
GARM.
Yes. That's lovely.
It's GARM.
Like, yeah.
Is it?
It's GARMing.
You're saying that. Is it?
Are you trademarking that, Chris?
I just did.
Nice.
GARM, like TM.
Going online now.
Like it.
So I think they're going to want to get involved, but they also have their other things. For example, a bunch of exchanges last year or this year released the programmatic principles. So they're trying to work together. So my challenge with this kind of thing, which, you know, OpenX and Rubicon and sort of four other exchanges are all part of, that's one thing they're trying to do to achieve better advertising for the publisher and for the advertiser, and to ensure that they are being more transparent as exchanges and they're working better with kind of all members of the supply chain. So that's one thing. How does that feed into GARM and what GARM is trying to achieve, and to, you know, to make sure that everything is brand safe, everything is fraud free, everything is as transparent as possible? There's going to be conflicts again. And if those members are represented via the IAB or via Coalition for Better Ads, will that be in line with what they as individual companies actually think and want? And is there opportunity for smaller companies that aren't Google and Facebook sized to take part in this? Because all the companies mentioned are behemoths,
big companies,
basically absolute behemoths.
Yeah.
So what about the smaller guys?
Yeah.
How will they be able to be involved in this? How will they be the sous chefs of GARM?
And how will they be allowed, perhaps, is the question.
Yeah.
Because this should be a win-win for everyone. You know, I mean, this absolutely should be, and this phrase, better advertising, is astonishing, really, that we're at a point where we've all got to get around a table and go, well, how do we make advertising better? When you ask consumers, generally, the sentiment over the last few years is the quality of advertising is going down. People are less engaged. And so it is absolutely the time to draw a line in the sand and to ensure that the engagements that we have between brands and the people who consume and use those products and services are better. And are driving more effective outcomes rather than just media efficiencies.
And therefore, it's that sentiment, you know, that really underscores why an alliance like this is important, right? Because I think you're right, it is a moment in time where many things are converging to come to, you know, the same conclusion, which is that content online should be of good quality, good reliable quality, and we should understand when it's verified, you know, so that sort of speaks to the fake news and sort of hate content agenda. And then going alongside that, looking at how some of that content is funded, you know, we need to make sure that the advertising that's underpinning that is good quality advertising, and connected to that, we need to make sure that the user experience isn't awful and that people feel as though they understand how and why they're being served those ads in certain environments.
I think that's exactly right. I think that in many ways, GARM is an attempt to get in front of a conversation that the industry knows is coming. And that conversation, the one that is coming, is when regulators and policymakers turn to the advertising community and say, hang on a minute, like, who's underwriting the fake news? Who's underwriting questionable content? Who's underwriting the platforms upon which we've got content that we as a society have got a problem? And when those policymakers look at the industry, GARM wants to have an answer ready for them.
Yeah. Interesting. It'll be really interesting to see how this unfolds.
That we've just made GARM happen.
I know.
Just did.
It's proper TM. I'm loving it. Okay. Second news story that I wanted to chat through with you guys is not widely reported, but covered in the US at the start of this week, is that Uber have relaunched their lawsuit against their agency Fetch relating to ad fraud. So this is a lawsuit that Uber originally brought against Fetch back in 2017, and then they effectively revoked it. It wasn't upheld by the lawmakers at the time, and so they withdrew their complaint, and then apparently Fetch put forward a lawsuit against Uber for non-payment of invoices. Now we're a couple of years down the line, and Uber have revisited this lawsuit. And they've added to their claims against Fetch, claims against various ad networks and exchanges relating to ad fraud on the basis of some of the impressions that they were paying for in the advertising and marketing campaigns, specifically mobile impressions as well in this environment. So why I'm interested in this and wanting to know what you guys think about it is because it feels like it's a bit of a blueprint for, you know, the advertising industry to start to question who takes responsibility for the supply chain regarding ad fraud. I mean, we talk quite a lot about ad fraud at ExchangeWire in general, and we've certainly, you know, talked about it on the podcast a bit. And this feels like it's a lawsuit that's sort of underscoring some of that. So what does it say about our trajectory in as an industry in trying to deal with ad fraud? I feel as though probably quite a lot has happened in between 2017 and 2019 to try to tackle ad fraud, particularly on the tech side. I mentioned IAB Tech Labs earlier on. We know that they've launched initiatives to slow down the unauthorized reselling of inventory like ads.txt, and that has been widely adopted in the industry. Not really, you know, quite sure of the eventual outcome, because we know there's still a lot of, you know, significant, in some instances, significant amounts of ad fraud out there. But we know that stuff has been happening. But it's really interesting that Uber are revisiting this lawsuit now, because they clearly think that they've got a case not just against Fetch but also against ad exchanges and networks. So what do you guys think of this? Over to you, Chris, first.
It's fascinating in the sense that what this case shows, and actually a recent case in Australia which went to court as well, is that we're seeing what has too often been just assumed or spoken, tested in the cold light of day of the judicial systems. And I think that's a good thing. I think it's right. And I think this is shining a light on stuff. And it's a harsh light. And if it's got to be harsh, then so be it. Because I think it's healthy and good that we're starting to see what has too often been subjective made objective through courts. It's painful, I think, in some of the conversations that it raises. It raises questions of trust, it raises questions of transparency, and it raises questions of the relationships that the different parties have within the industry. But these conversations have got to be had.
Yeah, and I've got some more questions about your perspective on that from an agency point of view. But Lindsay, I want to hear your thoughts first. What do you think about this?
It's interesting. It will draw up so many other questions. Like at the time when Uber first sued Fetch and then Fetch countersued, there were questions around, well, how will other advertisers think about this? Will they look at their agencies and go, we need to check. There's probably some sort of nefarious, dodgy dealings going on that we need to look into as well. And there was lots of concern from advertisers and agencies alike that would happen. And it didn't really come to fruition. And everyone then sort of questioned, you know, what Uber was playing at. And it was something around the fact that the agency was taking credit for clicks. Obviously, it was the method with which they were remunerated, which I think then made people look a lot at how agency remuneration models, which are still in conversation today, like do you have an FTE model, do you have a commission model, and they're still challenges that are still being addressed by a lot of agencies. The smaller independents, like the Fetches of the world, are kind of mobile specific, and the holding groups. I think that's still a question that's still being leveled out, and no one's really kind of got to the answer yet, and there's still a mishmash across different teams, and there's lots of arguments and fighting internally about that. From my experience of agencies and talking to agencies as well, but I think also the fact that there's been 2 years past, either Uber now think that given the changes, Rachel, that you talked about that have happened in the industry in the past 2 years, they think now is the right time to do it. But also, I think they've probably spent 2 years actually researching this and investigating this to come up with an even more solid case that this time won't get chucked out of court. I think it's taken them 2 years to find the evidence they needed. So that makes me think that it's going to be a lot of evidence, and that Fetch and the networks and exchanges named in this as well will have to come up with a really, really good argument as to how they think they're not culpable for this.
And that's what's really interesting, right? Because the article does actually mention that the, you know, in the paperwork for the lawsuit, they have actually stated that there's up to, I think, 100 companies that were involved in the...
Doesn't surprise me.
In the sort of, you know, reselling, I suppose, of inventory.
Conservative.
You reckon? Yeah.
Yes. I mean, think about how many partners you work with for one client. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean there are dozens of companies involved in just one element of this. And I think that the extent to which this ad serving and marketing serving ecosystem has spiraled, it is actually quite remarkable. And I think we're now dealing with the complexity of that and the interconnectedness of that.
And that's what interests me as well, actually, is to what extent, you know, where do you, as an agency, where do you feel agencies ought to sit in this in terms of responsibility? Because I think that Uber are probably going for a couple of things here. They're definitely going for a discussion about, you know, how they set up their agreements around remuneration with their agency and to what extent that was transparent or not. And then they're also going for and why there's so many partners involved in this and what responsibility did those partners have. What's your perspective on that, Chris?
Agencies are specialist capabilities. We are experts in what the best way is to plan and invest media in order to drive outcomes for clients. We are experts in that. And so that is what clients come to agencies for. And you've got to start there, right? I think that it's very easy for tails to start wagging dogs and carts to go before horses and stuff. But ultimately, what this is about is how do agencies make sure clients get the best possible benefit of their expertise? This means two things. It means robust, transparent conversations between agencies and clients on what the best possible solution should be for the client. But the other thing that it is really important is fair remuneration. And you cannot have this conversation. You cannot get through this debate without having a conversation about fair remuneration, not just between advertisers and agencies, but all the way through the ecosystem. How do you make sure that everybody involved is fairly remunerated for either the ad space and platforms they're providing or the services or capabilities that they're doing to drive ultimately the outcomes for the clients? And it's a virtue of so many players being involved, but also increasing pressure on having to deliver more media for less. It's that kind of pressure that means that years down the line we end up in court. And you know, you've got to deal with the cause of this. You know, tough on the causes of industry problems as well as tough on the outcomes.
Yeah, and that's another interesting point. You know, is it the case that Fetch could be sitting around thinking, well, hang on a minute, you know, we had these conversations about these campaigns so long ago that actually, you know, things have changed significantly in between now and then. And might they be thinking, well, you know, we discussed this to a certain extent and we advised you on a few things, but you didn't follow our advice. You know, to what extent do you think they will feel individually responsible? Obviously, we can't speak Fetch, but, you know, how much individual responsibility do agencies feel over things to a certain extent? And how much is, at what point are you sort of saying, okay, well, we can take care of this. This is our advice to you. Now, the final decision is over to you.
Absolutely right. And to your point, I'm not familiar with any of the specifics of this case, and I'm not commenting on the specifics of this case.
Yeah,
but
absolutely.
But more generally, I think it's absolutely the right point. I think that when we make those recommendations as agencies and when clients get those recommendations, it's really important that they are there in writing. We are agents. These aren't things that are chatted over a flat white, you know, on a Thursday afternoon. These are things that should be and are written down and clear, as are scopes of works, as are any contracts you might have with other parties. Yeah. Transparency and being clear on that and being having that captured should just be form. It's like if you get to a point where you're recalling who said what when, you're already in trouble.
Yeah, good point. It really does need to be quite open and upfront, not opaque.
Have to have a paper trail.
Yeah.
Always have a paper trail.
Absolutely.
Which is a shame, because the paper trail side of things does then kind of limit relationships between agencies and clients somewhat in terms of what you're trying to build. But at the same time, Chris, as you said, you know, your agents. You have to, you are acting on behalf of the advertiser and on behalf of a contract that you've agreed and a scope of work that you've agreed. So you have to, you know, even if you're in a monthly client meeting where everything is sort of discussed, you still have to then go and write down what you discussed. Otherwise, things get lost, things get missed. People could agree to something that then the higher up say, actually, no, why do you agree to that? That's not allowed. So there could be fault on Uber's side, there could be fault on Fetch's side, but actually you won't really know because something was missed.
Yeah.
And you won't know what that is, and that's the problem, really.
Yeah.
And I think just the other point to make on that is that I think sometimes we approach these conversations assuming that there is a perfect right answer, that the right media plan, the right schedule, with the right platforms, with the right ad units, that there is a right answer and everything else is not the right answer. That is not the case. What we do is as subjective as it is objective. And one of the things that we work very hard to do is to scenario plan and present those different scenarios so we can present different cases to clients. Well, if we do like this, this will be the outcomes that we project. Alternatively, we could do it a different way. There are different ways of getting to the same place. And I think that what's going to be tricky in a legal sense is, well, what is the right answer? When actually there is still, fortunately, a lot of subjectivity in what we do. There's still a lot of creativity in what we do. There is still a lot of subjective calls in what we do. And that's where actually the big ROI gets unlocked. And so you can't come at this thinking there is some perfect right answer for every media plan. In many occasions, you're looking at what is the best possible scenario that we're projecting the best possible outcome. But there's no right answer for it a lot of the time.
I guess because ultimately what is bought and what is planned is agreed upon with the client. Like, you don't buy anything without the client say so. But then that's a very top line look at things. And actually the semantics of what that actually looks like, because it was basically based on kind of they say you can do X, Y, Z to this target. What you then do in between is up for discussion, and that changes on a client by client basis. You'll have some clients that want to be involved every single step of the way and want to know exactly what is being bought and how and when and how much it costs. Others will go, yeah, as long as you get it to the CPA, then I will leave you to it. And if it's that kind of approach that Fetch and Uber had, then there will be cause for
a lot of opacity in that. Yeah,
exactly right. I mean, it'll come down to that trusted relationship that actually even once the schedule is agreed and locked, what are both parties doing to make sure they're measuring the outcomes of that, so that weeks and days and months down the line, they're having that joint conversation. Well, what were the outcomes? How were they versus projections? What did we all learn? What do we want to double down on? And what do we want to try doing differently next time? And they should be the foundations of these relationships.
And what about a discussion about, you know, in that sort of scenario planning, what about a discussion of the risks? Presumably you'll go through that too and say, okay, look, here's scenario A, this will be great for these reasons, but these are the things that could go wrong. I wonder if it's that conversation that's going to change quite significantly from sort of here onwards. I'd argue it probably has, it must have changed in the kind of agency client conversation over the last couple of years because of things like ad fraud. But I wonder if this case, once a little bit more light is shed on it, will be the sort of thing that will really start to change those conversations. Because also a little bit connected to the first story, people will start to feel a much greater sense of responsibility over the advertising that they're buying. So not only will they not want ad fraud because they don't want to be paying for that, but they'll also not wanting to do anything to support that.
State your assumptions. There are a lot of them. Whether it's projecting revenue from an investment curve, whether it's projecting reach from a reach-based scenario, whatever you're optimizing to, state the assumptions, because we do not work in a world with perfect information. We do not work in a world where every single outcome can be objectively projected. And so it's really important, no matter where you are in the ecosystem, that you state the assumptions that you're making, and that anyone who is purchasing advice or schedules or media space or clicks or whatever it is, when anyone is purchasing or investing in this ecosystem, they understand the assumptions that have been made to get them there.
Yeah, good point. Okay, let's move on to discussion of the third news story for the week. Facebook's long-awaited launch of their cryptocurrency Libra. I'm going to go with the star sign pronunciation, I think. being a Libra and all. It's going to be made available to the market apparently from 2020. And it's interestingly going to be managed independently by a, well, managed separately, I should say, by a Swiss-based foundation, which is backed by Facebook and 27 other companies and organisations, which include a few not-for-profit organisations, plus big brands and companies that we know very well, such as Visa, MasterCard, PayPal, Uber and Lyft, presumably because there will be merchants that you will be able to use these cryptocurrencies with. So it's set also to be available in a standalone app on iOS and Android, which means that it will be pretty routinely available, as well as within Facebook's properties, Messenger and WhatsApp. So this is interesting. It's not, all of the media releases made a very big point about it not being Bitcoin. It's a cryptocurrency. And there was also some fuss made of it being an initiative to help to bring payment solutions to people that either don't have access to regular banking solutions or are in all stable currencies. So, you know, you could read between the lines to assume that means perhaps people living in developing economies or countries that are, you know, experiencing very fluctuating economic circumstances. So very interested to know what you both think of this. It feels like probably a good time for Facebook to launch something like this and sort of throw the light away from privacy scandals onto, look, we're creating something that might be beneficial for
users.
Ah,
the classic smoke and mirrors.
This is it.
Don't look at that. Look at this.
Exactly. Distraction. Shiny new thing. So what do you make of it, Chris? I think you said in conversation with me, didn't you, you're astonished it took so long.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is really interesting in two ways. The first way it's interesting is, crikey, why has this not happened sooner? why is it taking so long? And it's like, I think that, you know, you could imagine the technocracy of Silicon Valley years ago looking east, young men and women, look east and see WeChat and WePay and just see the staggering amounts of money that are being spent on these integrated tech platforms. You can literally see like the jaws dropping across Silicon Valley and these like
little dollar signs
in the eyes. It's kind of going, it staggers me it's taken this long. That's interesting. What's also interesting is the positioning on this, that it's not just a payment platform, it's a currency, and that is very interesting. It's not just an Apple, hey, we can do credit cards too. It's not that. It's a much more integrated, future facing, agnostic payment platform, and that's interesting. But yeah, positioning, fascinating, and welcome to the party. Yeah. It's fascinating.
So, said from the lofty towers of Southeast Asia, where, like you say, you know, super utility apps have been here for quite some time. Lindsay, what's your perspective?
I think that is exactly the point. Like, if we were having this conversation back in London or in the US, everyone would be going, oh, I mean, what is this? How do we use it? But you guys are sitting over here going, are you joking? Like, this is why?
China is a cashless society.
Exactly.
Totally. There is no such thing as cash anymore.
Yeah. In fact, I say a lot in London, I live in a cashless society, but I feel quite alone in that, because even in London, which is becoming more and more cashless, you still need cash. And because China never had a credit card system, they don't have a legacy to have to deal with. We have a legacy credit card system to deal with. So Facebook coming out with its own currency is going to be very interesting.
Because it bypasses that, right?
Yeah, we still have so many legacy banking regulations and banking systems to contend with. They're trying to usurp that. Whereas in Asia, that's always, you've been able to do that for decades almost, because you haven't had legacies. And that's what I think is going to be fascinating about this, is how they're going to do that.
That's exactly right. I mean, whether it's peer-to-peer payment or whether it's micropayments, more Eastern-based markets have been able to completely leapfrog a lot of those established systems and just get straight to the point of how do you get money from one person to another or from one vendor to another really quickly and easily.
Yeah.
And that's what's particularly interesting, right? Speaking of usurping, because we know that, you know, in China and other parts of Asia where companies have managed to build super utility apps, the depths of data that they must get from those could be quite staggering, right? And we know Facebook loves a bit of data, so
and they love to use their data really, really well, and
that's right.
Yeah, as a very consumer thoughtfully would expect.
So, is this not going to, you know, whilst it's shiny new thing, look what we're doing, and whilst it's going to be really fascinating to see how this plays out, it's obviously going to have lots of, you know, relevant applications and use, and I'm sure it will take off in some capacity. It does still make you think, and what is Facebook going to do with that data? And I think they've stated already, you know, that data is not going to be used for anything else. It's going to be completely separate. Yeah, exactly. But we've heard that before, right?
Yeah, it'll still be used within their ecosystem.
Yeah.
And within their ecosystem, they can do a hell of a lot.
Yeah.
And that will still mean that it can exit that ecosystem very comfortably and people will be none the wiser because of the ability to enter that ecosystem in the first place means if you enter that ecosystem, you can then access that data. And that's what they're going to say, no, it's completely separate. That's not going to happen. But it's similar to them saying, we're going to be building WhatsApp, Instagram and Facebook on the same infrastructure. Don't worry, they're still very separate. They're all going to be completely kind of
independent.
Safe. Yeah. Well, they're not. Like, that's nobody believes you. Nobody believes what you're saying. But at the same time, for many people, and I guess this is the understanding of value exchange, which the young generation apparently do, and people in Asia apparently understand the value exchange, with, like, you know, with LINE and WeChat. Yes, they're using my data, but they're doing so and giving me a better service. Like, I don't mind as much because I know that it's actually helping me deliver a better service. Now, if Facebook can use that LINE and kind of convince the sort of Gen Y and Gen Z generation to understand how that works and why it works that way, then I think it could be okay. But Facebook have got a long way to go. And I think that in the established Western markets, they're going to struggle more than they will do maybe in South America. Yes. For example, in Brazil,
yeah,
WhatsApp is the most popular messaging platform that's ever existed. And is basically, if you don't have WhatsApp, you can't communicate with somebody in Brazil. Mm. So countries like that, this could do really, really well, but there really isn't much of an alternative and where there is that instability.
Mm.
I'm not saying Brazil is unstable because it's obviously not unstable. But,
No, but I know what you mean. And in other parts of South America where they have, significant economic challenges and currency fluctuations are very real. So, you know, people that are still transacting and doing business, and you can imagine small businesses as well. If there was a network of, you know, businesses and consumers that were using a cryptocurrency that they knew was safe and stable and that they could, you know, transact and buy other things on, you could really see that taking off. And South America could really be a place for that.
That's exactly right. I think that that anyone who comes at this from a more developed market comes at this through a paradigm of freely available credit. That is simply not the case in most parts of the world. There either isn't the credit infrastructure, and where it is, it's not freely available or as freely available as it is in more developed markets. And so there's huge potential for this in those markets. And the opportunity for platforms like Facebook is phenomenal. I mean, the two massive areas right now in terms of where companies are looking to make revenue generation, one is around social commerce and having payment infrastructure seamlessly integrated into Instagram is like a nirvana for Facebook. To be able to click and purchase within an Instagram post, it's tailor-made and ready for that. So they're going to be looking at platforms like Instagram to be huge opportunities in social commerce. The other one is around social gaming. And Mary Mika recently pointed out, the observation was that one third of the online population are social gamers. Now, even if that is optimistic, and even if that is an overreach, a huge majority of the online population are social gaming. And platforms like Clash of Clans, platforms like Fortnite, companies want in on it. Nike's advertising on the Fortnite platform. Brands are getting there, and brands are understanding that this isn't niche. This isn't just something else that exists on the internet. These are massive mainstream properties and propositions, and having payments seamlessly integrated on those platforms is going to have media platforms salivating at the opportunity.
That's very true.
Can you imagine?
It brings a new meaning to Farmville tokens. Like I remember, you know, back in my agency days where you'd run an affiliate campaign and the, you know, if I were to go and buy this insurance, I would then get 100 Farmville tokens rather than kind of cash or something else. And that used that was Facebook's way of trying to become, make things a unit of currency. So the Facebook for developers kind of, they will be gunning for all of the gaming developers right now. That's an idea, a very good point.
And that idea was probably ahead of its time. That idea was probably a decade too early.
You're right.
Kind of
it
idea.
Didn't really last and people tried it out, but because the adoption rate wasn't high enough. Well, that what am I going to do with those Farmville tokens?
Yeah.
Ultimately nothing.
And it was probably, you know, a couple of years back where gaming wasn't as widespread as it is now, whereas it is just becoming so much more widespread. And the gaming population, I mean, you're quite right, Chris, you know, brands are looking to reach people who are playing games because it is no longer this sort of subsection of, I don't know, you know, 13 to 21-year-old pimply young men in the basement of their parents' houses or the spare room of their parents' apartments or whatever.
Far from it.
Absolutely. And in fact, you know, we always have a little bit of a chat amongst ourselves being based in London. Whenever we're here in Singapore and on the metro, I'm fascinated to watch everybody gaming. And it is older people. It is, you know, and invariably, the, you know, people that are playing games with sound on as well.
Yeah, with the sound on.
Yeah, it's often an older person. I mean, you just, it's still to this day, you don't yet really see that in Europe. I'm sure older people are gaming, but not to the extent that that they are here. And that's what's fascinating. It's a whole other world.
It's a whole other world, and it's a world in which people are increasingly comfortable with virtual currencies, that whether it's V-dollars or whether it's gems or whatever it is, people are very, the idea of a currency that is not a dollar or a pound or whatever it is increasingly accepted and mainstream. And that, again, I think is what, to go back to the story, is really interesting. This is not a credit card. This is not an old school version of what money is. This is a very new school version of what money is. And it'll be fascinating to see where Facebook take it.
Yeah, and how it plays out. One more thing before we move on. Do you think, Lindsay, in Europe, we're just a little bit too suspicious of this sort of thing? Like, I can imagine it's stalling a little bit in, perhaps not amongst a younger generation, but certainly an older generation. I can imagine it stalling in some European countries where we're already very paranoid about data sharing, relatively paranoid about what Facebook gets up to, fairly mistrusting of payment transactions that aren't via sort of, you know, traditional institutions that we understand. What do you think?
I think we are going to be mistrustful of it. It comes down to, who do I trust less, my bank or Facebook?
And that's, I mean,
in Europe, that is
in a balloon debate.
Yeah, exactly. In Europe, that is a real concern. Yeah. I don't know the answer, frankly. But there are some countries, like, you know, Stockholm, for example, is pretty much cashless now.
Completely,
so
yeah.
Somewhere like Stockholm that is very, very advanced and often is a market that these kind of countries, companies will go and test these things, because it's a small test bed. You can get quite good read and then be able to roll it out across Europe, particularly the Nordics anyway. Those kind of areas, it could work, because they're already used to doing things like Venmo. There's even some people are inserting chips in their wrist so they can pay using a chip in their wrist rather than having to get a card or a phone out.
Amazing.
But for us that kind of are still very, think that there are people in the UK that still think that Apple Wallet and Google Wallet are terrifying, and that's still just your own credit cards that are stored on your phone, and they think that is not as safe as a credit card.
Yeah.
Which is ludicrous, because it is much safer than a credit card, than actually having a physical credit card. You know, it's going to take a long time for people to feel comfortable.
That's what I think too, because even the cashless sort of environment that we live in London is still somewhat part of the London bubble. You chat with anyone that lives outside London and they still carry cash around in their wallet, and they're a bit reluctant to use the PayWave on the ticket machines.
Yeah, I go back to my hometown and I use my phone to pay for things, and people stare at me. Yeah, I used Smart Shop in Sainsbury's, which is a local UK supermarket. I used Smart Shop with my phone and I was scanning the items in my big supermarket. This is in London as well, not even remotely.
Yeah.
And people thought I was stealing, because I was just literally scanning things and putting them in my bag. And all these shoppers that are going to the till, they were
staring at
you. Some really funny looks. So I think we've still got, it's starting and people are really trying to embrace this, but it's going to take a long time for very, very established
to penetrate the entire
European
population,
yeah,
I
totally.
Think. Yeah, I think it will be adopted quickly within some demographics and within some parts of,
yes, and, like, you know, like we would, for example, we would certainly use it just, you know, out of curiosity more than anything.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so therefore, as you said, to your point earlier, Chris, you can see that it's the kind of initiative that will have immense, has the potential to have immense success quite quickly in other countries and other economies, because culturally the approach will be completely different. Yeah. So thanks very much for discussion of those three news stories. Let's move on to the second part of the podcast, which is a bit more of a chit chat and focus on what you're up to, Chris, here at PhD. In prep for this, we discussed a couple of things that you're particularly interested in. We touched on one of them earlier on at the start of the session, which is the sort of, you know, a sort of reported, alleged declining engagement with advertising and marketing, and the extent to which that should be a problem that everybody in the advertising industry cares about. So maybe you want to say a little bit more about your perspective on that, and also talk a bit more about what you're focusing on at PhD here in APAC.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's exactly right. I think that, you know, as PhD rapidly approaches our 30th year and three decades of existence, we've as a media, as a comms agency, we've always been predicated on this idea that media shouldn't be currency. Media shouldn't just be the cheapest place to do things. There is a better way, this huge value that media and great comms planning can add. And if you look at the last 30 years, the last 10 of that hasn't really been kind. If you look at the emergence of all the ecosystems we were talking about earlier on, from a digital ad tech, MarTech system, if you look at the what we've seen, shareholders driving businesses to be much more short-termist in terms of how they operate, what we've seen really take a pace in the last decade is a short-termism, which is driving a decline in ad effectiveness. And that cannot be understated. We are seeing a short-termism, which is leading to a decline of ad effectiveness. Now, this is at best, despite all this tech we now surround ourselves with. At worst, it's partly because of all this tech that we surround ourselves with. So what we're doing at PhD is we're taking a step back, and what we're looking at is, what are those brands, what are those businesses that are growing, that are thriving? And by and large, they are challengers. They are brands that are thinking differently and that are challenging conventions and that are making and driving big outcomes by being small. And what we've spent a lot of time thinking about in recent months is, what are those behaviors? What are the lessons we can learn from those brands? We thought that was so valuable, we put it into a book. And so today we've launched a book, Overthrow 2. It's a sequel to a book we wrote a few years ago called Overthrow, imaginatively. and what Overthrow 2 is it revisits this idea of brands that are making a big difference by not necessarily being big.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And would you say that some of those brands that you're looking at that are growing, presumably some of them are digitally native, but are you also seeing some growth for traditional brands that are just completely reorganizing the way that they're delivering value to customers?
It's exactly right. I think that when you think about what are the rules, what is the rule breaker's rule book, if you like, what do you do if you want to break the rules? Yes, we're seeing really interesting D2C brands adopt this. We're also seeing big traditional mainstream brands adopt this. The rule breaker's rule book, how you challenge conventions, how you look to grow by thinking differently and by driving for effectiveness rather than efficiency, is something that is relevant whether you're a big conventional brand or a brand new DTO. And all brands can benefit from this advice.
And to what extent, what kind of impact, I mean, it's probably a bit difficult to say at this stage, because as you say, you paint a really interesting picture of the way in which advertising and marketing has changed, and the way in which brand sort of growth has changed, has really led everyone to become much more short-termist. But what do you think the longer-term impact of this will be on advertising and marketing? So if you're looking at how some of these brands that are growing now are doing things differently, what do you think advertising and marketing is going to look like sort of 10 years from now as a result of that, if you could say anything about that at the moment? It's a bit finger in the air.
I would love to say that I could say. What I can say is what I hope to see. What I hope to see is the convergence of short-term metrics and long-term metrics. I think that if you look at the short-term metrics that drive a lot of the ad tech ecosystem, whether it's conversions or whatever it is, you've got a very accurate read on the stuff that will make a big difference very soon, but not a big difference in the long run. You've then got a whole different set of approaches, whether it's econometrics or revenue-based projections, that will give you a read on investments in the very long-term view. And there's a gap. There's a huge disconnect between this. What I'd love to see is a convergence of long-term and short-term measurements, so that marketers and brands have got confidence in a holistic view on how their brand can perform today, but how their brand will also be performing 5 years down the line. The other outcome I hope to see is to jump back into what we were talking about earlier on, is just better advertising and better communications and higher quality communications and more considered communications reaching people and engaging people.
It's really interesting. I wonder, Lindsay, question for you, because, you know, in addition to ExchangeWire, obviously we also run content through our sister publication, DTC Daily. And so we spend a lot of time chatting with DTC brands. And we talk a bit in the office as a part of that about how consumption habits have just changed so significantly. So do you think the sort of stuff that Chris is talking about when looking at how brands are growing these days, whether they are digitally native brands or more traditional brands changing the way that they do things, do you think that is being driven by the change in our consumption habits, or is it happening the other way around? Is it that the way that brands are kind of connecting with us is what's changing how we consume? And what do you think that's, you know, if we were to think in 10 years' time, perhaps we could have this environment where, you know, the sort of short-term and the long-term sort of goals and metrics in advertising became perhaps even a little closer together so that you could understand the trajectory between the two. What do you think, you know, our consumption habits would look like alongside that? Because they seem to be intricately connected, and changing quite significantly, quite different to what they were 10 years ago. What's your view on that?
I mean, I do feel it's a bit classic chicken and egg, in the sense of, if you think about what direct to consumer is, I mean, direct to consumer has been around for decades. If you think, you know, like TV shopping, that is the kind of the old school direct to consumer model. Like if I want to try and buy something, yeah, Argos, we were talking about Argos and the other.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think there's, as long as there are models out there, people will embrace them. People might find them bizarre. The Argos model, who would think that creating a shopfront with no actual products in it and sticking them all in the warehouse and then making you choose something from a book and then going for our kind of Asian audience who have no idea what Argos is, but it's a bizarre business model, but it has worked. It's had its ups and downs, but it's worked.
Yeah.
And it's still alive and relevant today. They've had to kind of do things to make themselves more relevant, but actually direct to consumerism, it exists in whatever format the company wants you to make it exist. And you might find it weird to begin with, but then it just becomes more normal. Mm. And there are certain trailblazers in consumer trailblazers that will kind of go, oh, I've been buying, you know, Rachel, you're a great example. How do you buy your, laundry tablets now?
Yes, small.
Yeah,
thank
exactly.
you very much. DTC, little DTC brand in the UK. It is UK based, isn't it?
Yeah,
it is.
I think it's UK based. Yeah,
that will send me my washing machine and dishwasher tablets through the post in a handy little thing that fits through, you know, the sort of, you know, post door slot letterbox. Thank you.
I can't believe
he's looking at me like I'm an alien.
Post door slot.
You're not going to forget. I'm not going to let you forget that in a while. Post door slot.
I'm just going to blame it on my Australian heritage. Because what I was thinking as I was saying
that. What do you have in Australia?
What do you say?
We don't have something in the door. You have something at the end of your driveway or in your front garden.
Kangaroos just kick it in from the bottom of the road.
It's descending. The podcast is descending.
Post door slot
is just like a thrown down.
It's principally my fault. I can
letterbox anyway.
Thank you, letterbox. My point being that they've got this perfect product that fits through the slot in your letterbox that is typical for most homes in European, frankly, in European countries. And I mean, it's so cheap. The reason that I buy them that way, they're good quality, but it's so much cheaper than buying them from the supermarket in a big bulk container. And I mean, yeah, fascinating.
Whereas I'm still not ready yet. I keep thinking, oh, Rachel does this and it sounds amazing and it's much cheaper and it comes with your letterbox. box, I am thinking, I'm not sure if I can make that leap yet to the ones that I know and trust. So there's a lot of that, but it's people like you that will go, I'm using this, and I'll go, oh, that's interesting, I'll look into that. And that's how a lot of these brands grow. It is through word of mouth, and it is through kind of social sharing and social platforms. Yeah. And that's kind of, I think, what is driving a large part of what's driving kind of changes in consumer trends at the moment.
And social commerce and e-commerce is a massive element of this and driving the growth of these brands. And I think that the brands that have got more conventional distribution are absolutely looking to see what they can do to push into this e-commerce and especially the social commerce space as well.
Yeah, and I suppose that's a little bit about brand discovery. You're quite right. You know, how do we know about these things? Why is it that we shop the way that we shop or that we purchase things the way that we purchase? I can still remember my first experience of Argos, you know, coming to London, just thinking, well, this is quite fascinating actually that you can buy stuff that you can't see. I mean, at first, mistrusting.
I'm sorry, I'm still just thinking about post-door slots. I'm literally sitting here smirking.
I've destroyed my credibility. Listeners, I'm afraid both Chris and Lindsay are looking at me like I'm strange.
The Brits are baffled by this.
I think the Australians will be too. I fear that nobody will want to.
I can't think anyone's going to do this one. Yeah.
What I'm trying to say there is that I would not have been convinced of that model of buying things if it hadn't been a readily available on the high street, which was the way that you discovered stuff 20 odd years ago,
yeah,
right?
That's very true.
Whereas these days you discover stuff through social media platforms, conversations with people, but you know, through social media platforms, that's how that sort of stuff goes viral. And it does mean that is what has changed consumption habits. And I guess I'm another good example of that as well, in that I do virtually no high street shopping anymore because I don't have the time, and I am very convinced of the value and the convenience of shopping online. So even all my clothes shopping is all done online. I try all the clothes on at home. What I don't like, I send back. But I chat about that even with friends back in Australia where e-commerce hasn't quite reached the same level of convenience there as it has in European countries. And they're astonished that I'm not that interested in going into a shop anymore. I've just completely changed the way I consume things.
I think that's right. I think a lot of retail is changing. I think what's going to be fascinating are these emergent models we're going to see in the retail space, whether it's high street as experience, whether it's D2C, whether it's social commerce, whether it's whole categories shifting from ownership to subscription. Now, we could be a decade away from the idea of owning a car being the most ridiculous thing you've ever... Why on earth would you own the liability of owning a car?
This is what the car companies are actually trying to...
get their heads around.
The car companies realise that there's going to be a stage where people don't own cars, so they're building up to it. I mean, actually, it's interesting, Chris, when we came into this amazing office with this beautiful view, you were both astonished that 8 years ago, what's in front of us now didn't exist. And talking about the fact that Singapore has got what is going to happen to it is like town planning up to sort of 2030. They plan that far ahead. This is what the automobile companies are having to do at the moment as well. They are planning for a future that's going to be carless. So how can they remain relevant and be a part of that?
Yeah.
It can't be that BMW won't exist anymore. So they have to exist, but they have to exist differently on something that people aren't going to buy cars.
Yeah.
It's exactly right. And I think that what a lot of marketers are getting their heads around is that what you can no longer do is operate in a world where you're purely brand building or where you're even in the business of driving consideration or preference. Any marketer, any advertiser, any agency has got to be as interested in distribution and physical availability as they are in mental availability. And I think that's what's exciting and that's what's interesting. And I think that that's where these emerging models are opening up massive opportunities for brands that can have that really clear point of view on how they see mental and physical availability joining up and how they drive distribution as well as mental consideration and preference of brands. It's an exciting time. I think that the brands that have got a clear point of view on that for the long term as well as the short term will be hugely successful.
And just a bit back to the book that you mentioned, and because I feel like I've sort of hijacked the podcast with Letterboxgate.
We should go back to the book so that people take that out and not...
and not
what is that? What is that gap in a door where the magic happens?
I I feel I shouldn't comment, actually. One final question, because we're just about out of time, but back to your observation of brands' growth and what that looks like. Are there some particular, because your role's APAC, are there particular APAC observations that you've noticed that are distinctly different to other markets, or is that too difficult to say because you're kind of buried in APAC business?
I mean, they're absolutely universal outcomes. They're universal principles. And I think that what we will see is them playing out in unique ways in APAC. So it's really important that marketers focus on effectiveness rather than efficiency. If you aim for effectiveness, for example, you will be efficient.
Efficiency will follow.
Exactly. But no one ever became effective by going for, I'm going to be as efficient as possible. And then that you do not get those big outcomes. Carving out distinctive propositions with an audience, but also building reach for that. Integrating your physical, visual availability. They're going to play out in very specific Asia and APAC ways, but they're universal. And there is absolutely a rule book that marketers can use to navigate through these really interesting times. And that rule book is Overthrow 2, and it's available online, and just search for that. And it's in collaboration with Eat Big Fish and Adam Morgan and the team there, and we're really excited about it. So do look it up and reach out to PhD if there are any questions or follow-ups that anyone out there wants to engage us with.
Fantastic. Thanks very much, Chris. It's been fascinating chatting with you this morning. Thanks for having us in your office with the fabulous view. And thank you very much, Lindsay.
Thank you for coming to the equator. It's been great to have you. Enjoy your time here.
And the water does still go down the plug hole the right way. We're still in the Northern Hemisphere, right? Just
about. Yeah. It just goes very slowly the right way.
At least there are no letterboxes involved.
Well done.
And that
every day is a school day.
And that was the Mad Tech Podcast.